Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Giustina. Joining us this week is Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. We'll even talk a little bit about New Jersey today. Corinne Carey has led the lobbyist effort for many, many years. In fact, 9.5, ultimately. She won the battle in New Jersey. However, the fight continues in New York over the bill known as the Medical Aid in Dying Act. It was first introduced in the New York State Legislature in 2016. We'll talk about medical aid in dying. Some call it assisted suicide, but, you know, we're going to define it for how it is in the law in New York. Welcome, Corinne Carey from Compassion and Choices.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. It's an important issue to discuss. Obviously, there are arguments on both sides of this. And right now, give us some context. We're in New York State. We're talking about New York. How many states right now have laws on the books that allow for medical aid in dying?
10 states plus Washington, D.C. have adopted laws that allow terminally ill individuals to ask their doctor for a prescription that they can take at a time of their choosing or never, should their suffering become too great to bear and to die peacefully with those that they love around them.
We saw a recent case. I read about it in the New York Times. It was a Connecticut woman who wanted the right to medical aid in dying. She sued Vermont because Vermont has a law, but in the law, you had to be a resident. She sued, said it was unconstitutional. The state waived the residency requirement, and she was able to end her life in Vermont. How much of this are we seeing? And I'm sure that just opens the doors now in terms of lawsuits that are going on around this issue.
Well, it's true. The states that have passed medical aid in dying laws have followed Oregon's model because Oregon's model, by and large, has worked to allow people to die peacefully. But Oregon's law contained a residency requirement. I think the fear back in 1994 when voters approved the referendum in Oregon was that it would become a death destination. And that never happened. It's exceedingly difficult for someone who's been given a 6-month prognosis to pick up and leave and establish a new care team, get a new residence, go through the process and use it in those states. And so that just never happened. Of course, there are rare individuals that are able to do that. Brittany Menard, the young woman who was 29 and moved from California to Oregon, did it. There have been a few since then, but it's very rare. And in fact, what we found at Compassion and Choices is that it's so rare that that requirement of residency isn't necessary anymore. And New York's law does not have a residency requirement. It is the only kind of healthcare where you're required to be a resident. Certain states have banned care like abortion, but no state has said the only way that you can get the care that we have available to our residents is to be a resident. And so from our view, it's an unconstitutional restriction. And so we've sued both Oregon and Vermont. Both of them have waived those requirements and the legislature has since repealed the residency requirement. And we've also sued New Jersey. And that case is in process right now.
But you had a great success in New Jersey because a law got passed, right?
We did. So it does put us in a weird position that we passed the law in New Jersey and then we turned around and sued them. So
how would you compare your fight in New York to your fight in New Jersey so far? Obviously, it's in the legislature right now. We have super majorities of Democrats. So if the Democrats are in favor, and of course the governor, you would think that it'd be a good chance that 9.5 years in, you might have a law after the session. But give us a sense of what it's like comparatively to fighting it in New Jersey, a next door state to New York.
Well, it should be as easy as New Jersey. It took about a decade in New Jersey, to be honest, but the concerted effort to pass the law only took about 2 years. And I do think that New Yorkers are more skeptical than other lawmakers. So in New Jersey, we would go in, we would meet with lawmakers. They would have questions about how these laws have played out in other states, questions about the legislative language. We would answer them and lawmakers would take a position. And then we were able to bring the bill to the floor and pass it. And we passed it with more support than we thought that we had. Here in New York, we're seeing lawmakers, if they're willing to talk about death and dying at all, which is a big hurdle.
Interesting. Can I ask if it splits equally in terms of party line?
Well, that is a very interesting question, because unfortunately, if you look at the list of bill sponsors, we don't have a single Republican on the bill. However, behind closed doors, I will tell you that there's a tremendous amount of support among Republican lawmakers. Republican lawmakers telling us that they want the option.
What's the stigma for them? Why are they saying it behind closed doors and not publicly?
I think, David, we live in a hyper-partisan time, and there are some lines that you just don't cross no matter what.
But is it a religious reason? Is it we don't want assisted suicide to be permitted? Because there's several arguments that they use. We don't want relatives being taken advantage of. We don't want folks who are older and maybe depressed more naturally to then decide to take their own lives. Where do they fall? They use all those arguments or what?
You know, those are some arguments, and there are more. I would say that there are probably as many arguments that lawmakers have as there are lawmakers who remain opposed or on the fence. The Republicans don't fall into any of those categories very neatly. They tell us, not all of them, of course, but many of them tell us that they're sympathetic, that they're supportive, that they may even vote yes when the bill comes to the floor, and we'll see if that happens. But I don't think that they fall into any of these neat categories. A lot of it is just a personal discomfort with the idea of allowing people to die. And what I say to some of those folks, sometimes more bluntly than other times, is if you think it's uncomfortable to talk about death and dying, imagine what it's like to be a family member watching someone suffering terribly, begging for relief, and not being able to do anything to help them take control of their own death. Think of how difficult it is to be dying and, despite the best care available, to still be suffering in excruciating pain. That's uncomfortable. And what we found is that lawmakers who have had an up-close and personal experience with death and dying, either with a loved one or a terminal diagnosis themselves, it becomes real very quickly. And they see that it's just untenable to maintain a position opposed to medical aid and dying in the face of that suffering.
We're speaking with Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York, and they are currently trying to get the Medical Aid and Dying Act passed in the New York State Legislature. The law itself, I imagine over these years, you've crafted in such a way to eliminate some of these obstacles, to suggest, for example, that this is going to be looked over by a doctor, there are rules in place so that it's safe, that it's done so that we know that it's not something to do with the mental health of the person who's seeking it, right? So you're really making that very specific to make it harder for lawmakers to not support.
It's true. The bill is modeled after Oregon's law, for sure. The core eligibility guidelines in Oregon: one, that you need to be terminally ill; two, that you need to have a 6-month prognosis; three, that you need to be mentally capable; and four, that you need to be able to self-ingest the medication, have remained unchanged for more than a quarter of a century. Think about that, David. When a state passes a law that's new, normally it needs to be tweaked and fixed and the problems need to be worked out. But Oregon's model, because of how carefully it was crafted, works. And that's why every state that's followed has used the same core eligibility guidelines. Now, in New York, we've amended the bill several times to make it consistent with other areas of New York law, to address some of the concerns that some lawmakers have, to shore up some of the safeguards.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, just one that would require the doctor to inform a terminally ill patient of all of their end-of-life options, including hospice, palliative care, and any other viable treatment options. You know, we have the lowest rate of hospice utilization among those who are eligible of any state. We rank last in the nation. That's absurd. We are a state that's dedicated to quality care, and here we have care that is paid for by Medicare that very few people take advantage of. This law will actually open up the conversation, lead more doctors to understand better what the benefits of hospice are, refer more people to hospice, and then have more people enrolling in hospice. That's just one of the side effects that these laws have had in states that have adopted it.
You are running quite an advertising campaign right now. I see the ads all over the place in New York for Compassion and Choices. You have testimonials right within the ads. We meet people. First, let's start on the funding side. Where do you get your funding from? How do you get the money to run an ad campaign like that? And then two, put more faces on this for us. Give us examples of others who want this law to be passed because someone in their life or themselves might want to take advantage of it.
Oh, so many stories, David. But let me start by saying that Compassion and Choices gets our funding by and large from individuals. More than 95% of our funding
comes... A membership organization.
Well, membership, but also bequests. One of the major things that Compassion and Choices does besides legislative advocacy is we run an end-of-life consultation program. And so people who are facing a terminal illness or their families have the ability to call our toll-free line and ask an end-of-life consultation specialist about how to access the options that are available where they live. So even people in New York have utilized this hotline to try to navigate the hurdles in accessing the kind of care that they want at the end of life. And people are so grateful for that service because there aren't very many places to turn when you're looking at what your options are and you're facing barriers to accessing it. So bequests that we receive are from terminally ill individuals that got that kind of consultation from us and their families who are eternally grateful to the organization for helping them through a very difficult time.
Now let's meet some people. Tell us a couple of stories, if you would, about folks who are in a horrific, obviously, situation. But I always think about it, and I know others do, that one of the things we do for our family members known as our pets, we have compassion and we make the choice to put them to sleep, but only when there's no other option.
Right. In fact, I'll turn that around a little bit and say that if we allowed our pets to suffer the way we allow people to, we would be charged with cruelty. But people are not animals, and so we're not talking about putting people out of their misery. We are talking about putting the power of charting one's own end-of-life journey into the hands of the person to whom it belongs or it should belong, and that's the dying person, allowing the dying person to direct all of the options. In fact, it's the only end-of-life option that puts all of the power in the hands of the dying person. I have a really unique vantage point, having worked on passing the law in New Jersey and now working with the Murphy administration and hospitals and families in New Jersey to ensure that the law is working as intended and trying to push for it here. I remember one mid-February week, I got two phone calls. One of them was from a 24-year-old ballet dancer who was at the beginning of what looked like it was going to be a brilliant career. And she had been diagnosed with tongue cancer. Terrible. Just so rare, so out of the blue for her. And by the time she called me, she was having a very hard time speaking because much of her tongue had been removed to try to beat back the cancer. And she told me that she wanted, when all of her treatment options had run out, she wanted the option of medical aid in dying, and she was seeking our advice about whether to move to New Jersey. None of her care providers thought that she would live long enough to make it through the process, so she was discouraged from doing that, and she continued to receive care from, you know, a leading healthcare institution here in New York City. She ended up dying about a month after I met her in the worst pain that I have ever heard described to me. Her family was in touch with me many times since that time, and she then lost the ability to speak altogether. But I could hear her in the background as her mother and father talked to me during those last few days. Right around the same time that I heard from Ayla, her name was Ayla Rain Eilert, and her parents are involved in our campaign now. Right around the time that I heard from her, I heard from another woman named Anne French. And Anne called because she had just been approved for medical aid in dying by a doctor in New Jersey. And she was like positively gleeful. She said, "Thank you so much for working to pass this law. I want to tell you what a difference it's made in my life." And she went on to spend those last few weeks of her life after she got the prescription living life to its fullest, going on day trips with her husband. I remember one time she had her husband pull over and take a video of her crossing a bridge in her walker because she wanted to show me the difference between living on one side of a border and another. And so she filmed, you know, across the river saying, "These people who are sitting in the same waiting rooms as I am don't have this peace of mind that I do." I mean, she was so happy. And when she died, exactly the way she wanted to, at the beach with her husband by her side, Her husband texted me and said, Anne was at peace, and so am I. Thank you. You know, the contrast between those two deaths is profound. And Anne spent the last few weeks of her life doing advocacy with us because she didn't want anyone to suffer the way that she did before she got the prescription. And A. Lorraine Eilert suffered. And there's no reason why a zip code, a river, a mountain should separate New Yorkers from the right to have the kind of peaceful, compassionate death that Anne had.
Very powerful story from Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. In New York, they're trying to pass medical aid in dying. In this session, they've been working on it for nearly a decade now, and they await this session to see what happens. The next question I have is it still the same when it comes to polling New Yorkers? Do the majority of New Yorkers still feel that this is the kind of thing they would like to see passed?
Even more so now than they did a few years ago, David. I mean, I think the COVID pandemic really shed a light on what a bad death looks like and how people want to avoid a bad death as much as possible. And what does a bad death mean? It means a death where you can't communicate with loved ones, where you don't have the power of touch of loved ones, where you have lost all control. You know, we watch that as a nation, as a state. We watch that on the news every single night. And so, you know, the polling numbers are really high in New York, over 70%. And this is across pretty much every demographic, party lines, religious lines. Catholics support it at around 70%. My family is Catholic. It's not surprising to me that Catholics support this. They may not ultimately end up using medical aid in dying, but they understand that no one's religion should stand in the way of someone else making their own
choices. What about
choices?
Organized religion itself? What about the Catholic Church?
Well, they remain one of our toughest opponents
okay.
here.
See?
So, but they're completely out of step with the people who
are in their congregations.
Who are in their congregations, and that's not new.
Sounds like lawmakers may be a bit out of step with their own constituency as well.
Oh, they absolutely are. Public opinion is way beyond where lawmakers are at this point. Not all lawmakers. I mean, we've got 88 bill sponsors right now. That's not insignificant. 65 in the Assembly and 23 in the Senate. So.
And who are your major sponsors? Tell folks who are the major sponsors of the bill.
So Assembly Member Amy Paulin, who is a legislative dynamo. She's the chair of the Health Committee, and we are very lucky to have her carry this bill. And Senator Brad Hoyleman Siegel, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, who has always been a supporter, but even more committed now after he sat with a constituent who was on her deathbed and heard, you know, he spent several hours with her hearing from her what she was facing after, I think she had been through 50 chemotherapy treatments.
Oh.
You know, and she died suffering. And so that strengthened Senator Hoyleman Siegel's resolve to see this bill through.
Well, the big kahuna is the governor of New York. She is a Democrat. Kathy Hochul, is she tipping her hand one way or the other at this point?
Not at all. Governor Hochul is very good at not tipping her hand on this issue in particular. But I have to tell you, I've been a keen observer of the governor since before she became the lieutenant governor. I met with her when we were working on modernizing New York's abortion law. And I feel like she will come down in the right place on this. I know that she is a compassionate person, but, you know, when she says that the legislature needs to do their job and deliver her a bill, she's right. It is in the hands of the legislature right now. So it would be nice to know where Governor Hochul stood, but this is the job of the legislature. It's the job of Senator Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Speaker Hastie to bring this bill to the floor.
Well, what plans do you have going forward as we sit just before an April 1st deadline as your final push to hopefully convince enough lawmakers and maybe even have the governor tip her hand in your favor?
Well, you know, the second week of June sometimes feels right around the corner, but it's a lifetime in legislative session days.
It is.
So there's a lot more that we plan to do. We plan to highlight the voices of people living with disabilities who support this measure. In fact, recent polling shows that people living with disabilities support medical aid in dying in the same measure as the general public, or even more so. Why? Because of our movement's shared values of autonomy and independence and self-determination.
I don't know that I asked this or you mentioned this already, but what about doctors and medical associations? Where do they come down on these issues?
One of our strongest supporters is the New York State Academy of Family Physicians. And in 2018, Medscape did a poll of New York doctors that showed that overwhelmingly doctors support giving people this option. Even more doctors want this option for themselves should they become terminally ill. And then when told about what the bill would do and what it wouldn't do and what the safeguards are, that support grew to 67%. And so I don't think there's any question that doctors believe that people should have this option. Healthcare providers believe that it should be one additional tool in their toolbox to offer people for end-of-life care. But that doesn't mean that every doctor is going to be willing to prescribe medical aid in dying. It just means that, like voters, like people living with disabilities, we believe that this should be an option, and they believe that this should be an option.
And it should be an option for everyone, right? There's this issue of healthcare equity that somehow some will be able to take advantage of it while others will not.
Well, that's true. And I think that what we've seen in other states is that traditionally people who can be described as health literate, people who are able to advocate for themselves, people who are aware of all of their options, are the ones taking advantage of medical aid in dying laws in those states. And so there is an issue of equity. But that's something that we need to address as a society. And here in New York, we plan to address it with our civic organization partners across the state so that when this law is passed, we want to make sure that everyone knows that this is an option. It isn't going to be an option that everyone chooses. There are cultural and religious reasons and family reasons why someone might not do this. But everyone should be able to make their own choice to die in a way that's consistent with their faith and their values and their beliefs.
How can people advocate for themselves? How can they get in touch? What would you encourage them to do no matter where they are in this portions of seven state listening area and across New York?
Well, they can visit our website, compassionandchoices.org, but you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, all the different places. I don't think that we're on TikTok yet.
It may be banned. We don't know.
It may be banned.
By the time they hear this.
I don't think we're there yet.
Well, one of the people that sort of brought this issue into the minds of Americans, and I know there's maybe some young people won't know this name, is Jack Kevorkian. Where does the movement come down on him? And, you know, he was controversial at the time, certainly, but he created an awareness like nobody else.
Well, I think to a certain generation, yours and mine, Kevorkian was kind of a household name. Listen, he operated outside of the law, and some of the things that he did were incredibly questionable. Medical aid in dying laws do not follow that model. We are not putting the power in the hands of doctors to administer this medication, for one. And so, you know, I think that this is a very different model for putting the power into hands of dying people. The problem is, without medical aid in dying laws, people are operating under the radar. And I think that that's something that lawmakers need to acknowledge. We had a meeting with a lawmaker yesterday where it was almost like it was the first time he had thought about that. So what's happening now? If you're lucky enough to have a doctor who will operate outside of the scope of the law, then maybe they'll overprescribe medication. Or, David, we put the power in the hands of families to have this comfort packet with them when someone is sent home on hospice care. The hospice worker tells the family, you administer the morphine. If your loved one is in pain, make sure that you give them morphine. Now, don't give them too much because that could, you know, stop breathing and bring about death. But you don't want to give them too little because then they'll be in pain. So where does that leave family members? Well, first, it leaves family members who, you know, may not be operating above board with the power to end a life. Second, it also leaves them administering medication that may be the last dose. And that's something that people never get over, thinking of themselves as the cause of someone's death. And then the worst thing that happens outside of the law, outside of a structure where this is an approved, you know, above board option that's regulated, is that people take their own lives. So many of our supporters have come to us after a loved one has either taken their own life or has attempted to take their own life and has ended up on life support. Doctors have joined our movement because a patient of theirs has taken their own life. And those situations are tragic and they're traumatic for the EMS professionals, for the family, for the community, and for generations to come. That's the impact that suicide has. And that's why, an additional reason why this law needs to pass, because we need to make sure that this happens in a way that is regulated, that is safe, that is above board, and that doesn't cause this kind of trauma.
Forgive my ignorance. What's happening on the federal level?
Medical aid and dying laws are governed by the state.
So you can't
have a federal law that allowed, because the police powers rest with state governments. I will say that the federal government has long had a law that prohibits any funding to go towards medical aid and dying in the states. Actually, I want to add something about the Assisted Suicide Funding Restriction Act, and that is that when these laws pass, people who receive their health care through the VA, for example, are not eligible to have their end-of-life care paid for by the VA if they choose medical aid in dying. That's true for Medicaid recipients as well. So it does create a big barrier for people in terms of equity.
There's just never enough time to have these important conversations. We have been here with Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. Corinne, an important issue. No matter what happens, come back again and speak about it in the future.
I'd love to, David. Thank you so much.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.
Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.